Hey, what's up, everybody? My name's MJ, and you're listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. As usual, I'd like to give a quick shout-out to my local game store, Guardian Games. You can find Guardian Games on the web at ggportland.com. On today's episode of the podcast, we're going to be talking about Oathbreaker. And if you have never heard of this particular format, well, you're in luck today, because I am introducing my very special guest, Chad from Signature Spellbomb. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really am happy to be here today.
Yeah, it's great having you on about this format that I do have a little bit of experience with, but again, is something even I would like to learn more about. So, before we begin, where can people find your content on the internet?
Well, I'd love for people to find me at Signature Spellbomb on YouTube, but that's kind of where I need the most help at the moment. But if people just want to talk to me and have a good time, I'm on Twitter. And I'm often doing games with J-Ro on Summon Skull on Twitch. So that's a great other place where you can also see on Wednesday's weekly Oathbreaker gameplay. So that's a cool place to go too.
Yep. And again, if you have been listening to my episodes with J-Ro on here, you can find him on Twitter at Coach J-Ro underscore J-R-O. I never quite get that right. But anyway, and if you're interested in getting involved in these games, you can ask him for Discord information by DMing him on Twitter. It's probably the best place. The Unsummoned Skull Discord server and community is a great place to go if you're looking for any games of any format EDH-related, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, and he's got a very welcoming and awesome community, so definitely get in there if you want to get in some great games.
Yep. All right. So we're basically going to be talking on today's episode about Oathbreaker, what it is, what sets it apart from EDH, but also some of the things that you think that EDH players can really get out of trying out Oathbreaker, given the fact it is a different format, yet it's also fairly organic, just like EDH was at the very beginning. But before that, again, we were talking in the pre-show about some very interesting news about the online game regarding Brawl, regarding Oathbreaker, and why don't you go into that a little bit here for those people who haven't heard about this announcement?
Oh, yeah. So earlier today, WotC made a put out a news article about an update that's coming to Brawl. They're going to be unbanning some cards and weighting the legends in those decks so that you get more fair play with other people in Brawl. And they're also going to do 100 card variants. So Brawl has always kind of been almost EDH, almost Oathbreaker, available for you to play against people on Arena if you weren't able to get into a game store during quarantine. So them increasing the deck size up to 100 cards and removing parts of the ban list will kind of allow a lot of people to play historic Commander on Arena. So there's going to be a free event, and then they're going to actually go from, I think, June 18th through July 25th. I don't have any of the information in front of me, but if you have a chance, check that out on WotC if you're interested in getting in some historic Brawl.
Yeah, sounds good. And again, Brawl is standard legal, correct?
No, this would be historic legal.
Okay, because Brawl is typically standard legal cards only.
Not for a long time. Actually, historic Brawl has been the mainstay on Arena for a little while now, and I think people enjoy that because, well, when you try to make Commander a rotating format, it causes a lot of problems. You've probably felt that in the EDH community yourself, right?
A little bit. I mean, I like the fact that there aren't any rotations, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so when it was linked to Standard, it caused a lot of problems because people's decks, you know, kept aging out of the format. With it being historic and historic essentially being non-rotating, it's probably just a better home for Brawl at this point.
Okay. It definitely shows how little I've paid attention to this, I suppose. But it's definitely interesting information nonetheless, and hopefully it'll get more people into EDH and into Oathbreaker as a result.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so to the meat of today's episode, again, I really wanted to talk about Oathbreaker with you since a lot of your content is based on Oathbreaker, and I wanted you to give a quick overview of exactly what the format is for those who haven't heard of it.
Yeah. First, I would just like to take a second to get into the history. So the people at Weird Cards Charitable Organization, which is also related to the Magic Kids Charitable Organization, are a group of amazing individuals. They all work as medical care providers I can't really say where because it's not related to Oathbreaker, but they would try to get in EDH on their lunches, and they didn't have enough time, so they needed something a little bit faster. And that was the birth of the Oathbreaker format. The main differences in Oathbreaker is that it is a 60-card singleton deck. You have a Planeswalker as the commander of your deck. Your deck does have to fall in your Planeswalker's color identity. And as additional card in your command zone, you have a signature spell that has to fall in your Planeswalker color identity. I'll get into that a little bit more in a second, but essentially, the construction isn't that much different from EDH, but you've only got 20 life. So it plays a lot more like a 60-card Magic game with 20 life. So it's a little bit faster, and I think that's probably the thing that would throw most EDH players off, because you don't have as much time as you do in EDH to get to some of your big end game finishers. The other big thing worth mentioning is getting back to that signature spell. It's a spell you can only cast when your commander's on the battlefield, and every time you do cast it from the command zone, it also is affected by the commander tax, increasing its cost by two generic mana each time you cast it. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. Very small ban list at this point. In fact, the most recent thing that happened in the format is they unbanned an additional card.
And which card would that be?
Oh, World Fire.
Oh.
A 9-mana sorcery that basically ends the game. They realized that for the format, it didn't pose the issue they thought, because it's not often going to be fast enough in, like, say, a mono-red deck, if that makes any sense.
Isn't that the card that effectively exiles every permanent and puts everyone's life total down to 1?
Exactly. That is exactly the card. Yeah, I want to see 6/3 red.
Yes, yes. I know what you're talking about. It is banned in EDH for a reason, but I can see how an Oathbreaker, it wouldn't necessarily be a problem, because you have to get to 9 mana to cast it, and then plus have your commander out as well. And yeah, I see a lot of hoops to jump through there.
Yeah. I guess one other thing to mention here that would probably... So you can't apply, of course, the EDH ban list to Oathbreaker. One of the things that's banned in Oathbreaker to keep the format kind of on keel is a lot of your fast mana. So, like, Sol Ring isn't in the format. And so, because you don't have Sol Ring and you don't have Dark Ritual, you don't have, I can't think of the name of the Commander Lotus, it actually makes getting to that 9 mana for some of those big game-ending spells a little bit tougher. You have to work for it.
Oh, man, not even Dark Ritual?
No Dark Ritual, yeah.
Wow.
They found out, funny story, people would run Dark Ritual in the deck, not even as a signature spell. And in many games, they'd be running like the 3-mana Liliana. So turn 1, they had Dark Ritual. Turn 2, their signature spell, Smallpox.
Okay.
So it puts everybody else behind a turn. And then from that point on, you've got a Planeswalker on the field, and you can keep people basically locked down the rest of the game. It was so oppressive that they decided, I wish they would have, you know, banned Smallpox or something else that was the problem, but I feel like maybe that was a rabbit hole where they would have had to ban way more spells than to just ban one Dark Ritual, but...
Probably. I just remember utilizing this. So, again, for a full disclaimer for everyone out there listening, I have actually tried Oathbreaker for a little bit. It goes back to when I first started playing Magic. So I started going to my local FNM. I started to learn how to play the game, albeit very slowly, and quickly got introduced to this concept of Planeswalker cards. I didn't quite know what to do with them. Obviously, you know, most of the videos online didn't tell you about what they were for. But I was introduced to this weird alternate format called Oathbreaker, where you had a commander, you know, being a Planeswalker. Since I started playing right after War of the Spark came out, there were a lot of Planeswalkers to go around.
Yeah, I'd say the two best sets for somebody getting into the format right now would be like a pack of War of the Spark, because you're guaranteed to get a Planeswalker, and honestly, a pack of Strixhaven, because if you get any Mystical Archive card, you can probably make some use of it.
Most likely
is a signature spell. They're all good instants and sorceries. Kind of like, I feel like Dominaria was really good for Brawl and EDH, because there was a legendary creature in every pack.
Probably, yeah. Anyway, so I... tried to put a deck together. Again, this was a very cursory effort. I'm not really sure if it was good or not. Again, if people have been listening to the show enough times, you've probably heard about my really junky Modern Legal Mono Black Zombies build. Anyway, I built around the War of the Spark Liliana copies, so again, mm-hmm. the 6-mana version. And I seem to recall in one of my games actually running Dark Ritual as my signature spell. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, again, I didn't quite understand how things worked out. And it actually worked out fine the first time, but then about the second time you want to cast, you realize it nets you 0 mana. So it was kind of the dumbest idea possible. But it's just funny that mm-hmm. that we kind of brought up Dark Ritual there, because I have used that in Oathbreaker in the past. But mm-hmm. anyway, long story short is I discovered EDH very shortly thereafter, and the Oathbreaker mm-hmm. community that I had of like 3 people fell apart right after that. So ended up switching over to EDH, and Oathbreaker mm-hmm. basically never graced my deck pool again. So mm-hmm. yeah, after that, I kind of lost track of where Oathbreaker was, but again, it's still something that I think is interesting to me, given the fact that mm-hmm. it definitely pushes the boundaries of where we are as EDH players, because instead of being forced to utilize only one of the Planeswalkers that is allowed to be your commander per EDH rules written on the text, you can use mm-hmm. any Planeswalker that has ever been released as your commander.
Yeah, you know, and I think, oddly, there's a lot of freedom in that, because Planeswalkers are a very different type of card, but oddly, it's also quite a bit more restrictive as a format, because there are not Planeswalkers in every color. You know, there are gaps in color identity that just haven't been filled yet, because there's just not as many Planeswalkers as there are legendary creatures, so.
And you only have 2-color Planeswalkers anyway at max. You don't have a 5-color option for this. Maybe 3 colors with Nicol Bolas,
but yeah. You have one 5-color option. The 5-color option is a silver-bordered.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so our group has a couple players that do actually use it, because what else are you going to do? But at one point when we were playing live and in person, I was playing at Hobby Town, is one of my local stores. We had a group of 16, maybe 20 Oathbreakers, you know. So it's like your format at your game store, EDH ended up becoming the dominant. Ours just went a different direction. I think it was because the driving force, I'm going to blame myself, I think, mostly for this, but me and my friend who started up the Magic group again there, I just built budget decks, which is most of what's on my channel. And when somebody was interested in sitting down and play with them, I'd hand them a deck and they could play. And then if they were interested, I'd just give them the deck. So the main reason I build budget decks is it's a lot easier to get somebody into a game and get them playing Magic if they don't have to invest anything. It takes a lot of stress and pressure out of how expensive this hobby can be.
Oh, definitely. No doubt.
Also, kind of guaranteed early on, before people started investing, that the decks were kind of at a similar level, so nobody was really like blown out. The power level issue wasn't big in the beginning, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and that's something else I wanted to ask you about, is we keep having these ongoing conversations that never end in the EDH mm-hmm. community about power level, about trying to match up deck strengths against each other when joining a pod, rule zero, things like that. Mm-hmm. Since Oathbreaker is played very similarly to EDH, I'm just wondering, has the Oathbreaker community also had a similar issue where there's been talks about where the format is trying to go? Is it still trying to stay kind of a casual format, or are people looking more to try to push the optimization level higher and higher to the point where it is almost more like the standard 60-card regular formats versus EDH in theory being a more casual, slower format?
So, you know, the experience does differ from playgroup to playgroup pretty widely, I've noticed. There are sometimes I jump on Joe Rowe's stream, Unsummon Skull stream, and the game of Oathbreaker I play is tough, because I'm coming in from a very, very casual group. So I have not maybe gauged my opportunity. When you build on a budget, you're not hitting everything you need to maybe be the most optimized, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, definitely.
So I have experienced both. I've experienced J-Row himself on Summon Skull loves EDH, but I think he prefers casual. You know, I think that's why he likes the idea of his bubblegum EDH league, as he prefers just watching the big insane things happen and just having a great time, you know, which I really appreciate. And that's kind of what I come to Oathbreaker for. I think the issue of power levels and balancing decks against one another is hard because it's such a subjective issue. Because if you're playing with a very casual group, but you feel like you're winning more often than not, you can rank yourself 7 or 8 because you're winning pretty frequently. And then you end up against an optimized play group and you realize, oh shit, I'm a 4. Pardon my language. I'm sorry.
It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's not really a problem that plagues specifically EDH or Oathbreaker. I think that's just a problem you're always going to run into maybe with multiplayer. I think it's something that comes down to when everybody's sitting down and rather than having a competitive experience, they all want to have an experience together. The expectation shifts, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, sure. This is the same problem that I have in EDH because, like you, I am a super budget builder. I try to keep my budgets down while still trying to get the decks to do some function. Mm-hmm. But I always come to the table with a very casual deck. I want to make sure that my deck is able to do what it needs to do and has time to do that. But I'm also not trying to run fast mana. I'm just trying to get there eventually with what my decks do in a very casual way. And I guess something that's kind of kept me from getting back in, or at least really starting to think about getting back into Oathbreaker, was I was hearing a lot more about, well, turn 3, turn 4 wins. And while that would be fine, I suppose, it doesn't necessarily always mesh with the way I look to play the game. So
that's fair.
Yeah.
That's totally fair.
Yeah. So I guess it concerned me a little bit and gave me some pause about that because that's not necessarily how I enjoy the game personally. I'm not saying anything against people who enjoy that, but I'm kind of the person who would like to choose just a random planeswalker out of my collection, maybe cost 5 or 6 mana, build kind of a dirtly deck around them, you know, just allowing me to just enjoy having that planeswalker out there.
Yeah.
And
preach, brother, preach.
Yeah, and just be able to play the game with a bunch of like-minded people. I mean, again, going back to my Liliana example is that card was my first chase card, really. And I remember how excited I was to pick that up in a pack. It was a $20 card. And I just wanted to play with it because it was super powerful. And the fact that Oathbreaker offered me an opportunity to be able to build around it and utilize some of my awesome zombie cards, well, you know, that was really cool. But again, we weren't talking about anything where I was really trying to get anywhere. I just had a whole bunch of cool zombie cards that I threw together in a mono black pile. That's really all it was. And
you wanted to play kitchen table magic is what you wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's really where our local meta was at that LGS. It just happened to be very, very casual play. Mm-hmm. And it was a great learning environment for that. So it wasn't good for learning about, okay, what are the best way to do things, but it was a great way to learn, here's how to play the card game, and here's how to really just try to enjoy what you're doing. So it was a very nurturing environment for that. And it really helped settle my interest in EDH because I found that, hey, other people enjoy playing casual as well. Maybe I should join that. And I do definitely look at Oathbreaker as an opportunity to remain casual. It's kind of challenging, especially since it's a format that not a lot of people have really played or really know a lot about. Just kind of know where people fall on that scale, you know?
Yeah, I'd like to speak to some of the misconceptions you brought up there, actually, because I think you made some really good points. So a common misconception is when Oathbreaker first rolled out, a whole bunch of competitive players came out of the woodwork posting things like, well, if you just run this card with this signature spell, blah, 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 and the format's broken and everyone's going to win turn 3.
Oh, I remember that with the Elder spell. That was the first one that I heard about. I can't remember which commander it was who was using that.
It works really great with Nicol Bolas, actually.
Okay, yeah,
which
yeah.
Which is just very flavorful. However, that Nicol Bolas is not cheap. There's a mana investment there, and I think people conflated the ability. But no, if everybody approach the format not is if everybody approaches every format as 100% competitive format, I don't just want to have fun and play this game with friends. Yes, formats are going to seem broken. EDH is broken by the same metric as Oathbreaker is, using that logic. Most of the decks people point to and say, well, why don't people just run that? There's a couple reasons. One is it's no fun. A turn two win against three other people ruining three other players' day is not really an event. That's not exciting. That's not really fun. Two, if you put a planeswalker in your command zone, along with an obvious combo signature spell that's going to cause you to win the game, and there's three other people who can see your exact game plan on the table, in EDH, how do people respond when they realize you've got a game plan? Do you suddenly become the Nicol Bolas, the archenemy at the table?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so the reason I don't think you see the ultra-competitive decks or the two-card combos that win early that people talk about is, one, they're assuming some cards are in the format that are banned, like Dark Ritual, and two, they're assuming the other players aren't going to interact, which is, frankly, a little bit insane. It's a weird misconception to think the format's broken and that people aren't going to want to stop you from completing your game plan, because that's literally what EDH lives on. That's what Oathbreaker lives on. So I feel like those misconceptions hurt the game. I feel like there are very big gulfs in what makes Oathbreaker and EDH fun. Some decks live better in each format. Like, for instance, if you want to play a mill deck in Oathbreaker, it is way more feasible. In fact, Tasha's Hideous Laughter basically makes a deck now. You know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That new card, if you haven't heard, from the D&D set that's coming up, where every opponent will mill 20 cards for 3 mana.
It's 14. It's 14. 14? Yeah. Yeah, okay. But, you know, you count a player's opening hand size as 7, you count the draw every turn, you count the number of times you have to play it, you only have to cast it 3 times. So even with the increased generic mana tax on top of that, I don't know if that's going to make it as a signature spell. That's one of those ones where I do think there might be a banning in the future.
Sure.
But it's certainly, you can't really play mill when you've got to mill 300 cards worth of opponent's cards. It's much, you can in EDH, but it is hard. It is a trek. And I also feel like there's way more of a home for just fast, low to the ground, you know, aggro decks in Oathbreaker than there is in EDH, because getting over 20 life per player and getting over 40 life per player is also a huge difference, not just in gameplay time, but in the goal you've set for yourself. You know, there's no commander damage, so at least you don't have to look out for that. But that's, you know, there's ideas that just work very differently. I feel like a deck like Boggles is probably actually stronger in Oathbreaker than will be in EDH. So decks that maybe appear in Modern or Standard that never make it to EDH might have a home in Oathbreaker that people might want to try out. I have a Snow deck that was a Modern deck that I converted that I absolutely love. And with Kaldheim coming out, it actually finally got the cards it needed to kind of feel complete to me, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, sure.
So one other thing I'd like to speak to, and I think it's a good point you made. It can be hard for people to switch formats, because it feels like you've got to spend money. Like there's some sort of investment you have to make to switch or move into another format. I'd just like to mention, a lot of people have standing card collections. Almost everything that's good for a singleton format, like EDH, still good in Oathbreaker. And a lot of people don't know, but they have secret Oathbreaker decks already. They probably have a two-color deck that they love, but it doesn't play fast enough in EDH to make a showing. That if they just put a planeswalker in front of it, or might even have a planeswalker in the deck ready, and removed 40 cards, they've got an Oathbreaker deck. It's really that simple. A lot of people have secret Oathbreaker decks that they just haven't played with yet, you know?
That's a very interesting take on this, because I know that as a deck builder for EDH, I definitely build my decks in one way, and usually there's a bunch of flaws in them. So I can definitely see how, in some cases, if I could find the right planeswalker, one of those decks could be downgraded, I suppose, from 100 cards to 60
you're
cards.
You're moving 40 cards of chaff at that point. You think about the fact that a good portion of those are going to be lands, because you don't need 30 to 40 lands in a 60-card deck. That's insane. Well, some commanders want that. If you're running Ren and Six, you're running a land-based...
you're running Lord Windgrace.
Yeah, You know, the fact that he's a problem in both formats does not cease to amuse me. I mean, a Lord Windgrace deck running the Gitrog Monster, it runs a lot faster when you only have to get through 60 cards to set up the combo than when you have to get through 100. You know? I do feel like combo decks have a better home in EDH. That's a personal opinion. It's just you, it always seems to me like you have more time in EDH. You know?
That's fair.
Yeah. Also, I feel like in a 60-card deck, you don't get to run quite as much interaction if you want to really dig into your game plan and win. You know, and in EDH, it's necessary for you to run, like, X amount of board wipes, X amount of just targeted removal spells, just to stay in and deal with problems as they arise, so...
Sure, versus the normal 60-card format where you sort of have to pay attention to what you're trying to do, and you don't necessarily have a lot of ways to interact with your opponent or the board.
Yeah, you know, there's another content creator I'd like to just shout out here, Justice. Sure. He's the Gate Watcher. He does Oathbreaker content on YouTube. He also does a lot of budget Oathbreaker videos. All of his videos use what he calls the 6x6 method, which is a very simple deck creation method that's existed for a long time, but it's the idea that you have 24 lands, you come up with the 6 tactics your deck needs to win, and that could be removal, draw, whatever. Basically, you know, you've got 6 cards in each of those 6 things, and that's just a good place to start. And then you can add and remove cards as necessary to tool the deck later, but that's a very quick way to get a 60-card deck put together and just start playing, you know? So yeah, I certainly suggest the 6x6 method to new players, you know? People who haven't quite learned what the mana curve is yet, you know, it's a good place to start. There's a lot of hidden math in Magic that you got to know to get better at it, is what I've realized.
All right, so moving on, since we've been talking about Oathbreakers so much, what are some of your favorite decks that you've either piloted or you've seen that really, I think, fit the concept of the format?
You know, so since the format is so wide and open, it's so interesting to see what other people bring to the table. I keep bringing up J-Ro, but he's got an amazing group hug deck, which is not something that would work in other 60-card formats, but it works in Oathbreaker, and it's very fun to play against. I enjoy when he breaks that out. Give me a second. I actually am always building decks. I've actually got 18 decks currently.
Whoa, that's about how many EDH decks I have.
Well, and they come and go. They get mantled and dismantled. Right now I'm working on changing some of the Strixhaven decks. So one of the second ones I open is actually probably one of my favorite just for how janky it is. It's a Jessica, the Thrice Reborn deck. It uses Volcanic Torrent as the signature spell.
And can you remind people what that does real quick?
Yeah, yeah. So I'll go through Jessica first. She's a 0 loyalty planeswalker for 2 and a red, which sounds terrible, but it gets better. She enters the battlefield with loyalty counters on her for each time you've cast her from the command zone this game. Her 0 loyalty ability is to choose target creature until your next turn. That creature would deal combat damage to one of your opponents. It deals triple that damage instead. Her minus X is to deal X damage to up to each of 3 targets. So she takes a little bit of work, and in mono red, you don't have, sadly, you don't have access to much proliferate. So she's kind of hard to get up there, but honestly, tripling the damage of an attacking creature is just amazing. Volcanic Torrent for 4 and a red is a sorcery with Cascade, so that's already a dirty word.
Mm-hmm.
It deals X damage to each creature and each planeswalker your opponents control, where X is the number of spells you cast this turn. So the main reason to run those together is you get everybody else's boards wiped, you get one creature out, and Jessica makes it into a game ender. You know, pretty straightforward. What makes this deck kind of fun and unique and interesting to me and janky is that the entire deck is only built using cards I opened up out of my box of Commander Legends.
Okay.
So one of the reasons I like it is a block-constructed deck that only has cards in it from that, and it actually works real well. It causes some trouble. Probably the best heavy hitter in the deck is Rograth, the son of Rogoth, or however you say that nonsense.
Zero cost kobold there.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, if you're gonna go big, you might as well, right?
Might as
so,
well.
So yeah, I love that
you
one.
Can't go wrong with a 0-1 with double strike and trample, is that right?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, it's... I just put it away, and that was my mistake. I was
Or the first strike. Either way, Rogrok has been a very popular card in EDH. I don't see as much now as I used to, but for a little bit there, it was super popular.
Yeah, zero, first strike, menace, and trample.
Oh, yeah, even has menace. Jeez.
Yeah, and of course, I'm running Haunted Cloak in here, so he ends up with Vigilance and Haste, too, eventually. It's nonsense. I love it. And honestly, it plays a lot like, so the EDH equivalent, I would say, to this is probably a Shun Yun Prowess deck.
Okay.
Where you just one-punch man somebody out of the game. So usually it'll pop up, it'll surprise somebody, you one-punch somebody out, and then the other two players go, oh, we have a real problem here. And then that's kind of where the game usually ends for me, but I always have fun, you know, I always enjoy it.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part sometimes with having to deploy your strategies, that people start noticing in a multiplayer game and it becomes a problem quickly. I get that sometimes. Yes. In my play group with EDH, is you got to learn, especially when you play with the same people a lot, you come to know what they're going to do. They don't necessarily know what you're going to do, and you just have to kind of work around it and figure out when to deploy your resources best and when to kind of save it for the next turn. So...
yeah, I think I'm just probably going to tell you about the next two decks out of my box.
Sure.
And I won't dig any deeper because I just want to give some variety as an example. So that deck was obviously, you know, heavy aggro. The next one I want to talk about, and like I mentioned earlier, is my Tamio Field Researcher deck. So she's a Bant, 4-mana Planeswalker that comes into play with 4 loyalty. Her plus one is to choose 2 target creatures until your next turn. If either of those creatures deal combat damage, you draw a card. Her minus two is to tap 2 target non-land permanents. They don't untap during the controller's next untap step. And her minus 7 is to draw 3 cards and then cast Omniscience, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that's an emblem people need.
That's a good strategy right there.
Yeah. So this is actually the snow deck I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So the signature spell is Glacial Revelation for 2 and a green. I reveal the top 6 cards of my library, and I can put any number of snow permanents from among them into my hand and the rest into my graveyard.
Okay. So you're basically just getting really good card advantage out of this.
I'm often getting 6 to 7 cards because it hits every land, it hits every artifact. Cards, there's a couple cards in the deck that aren't, but big ones to hit is Merit Liege's Slumber. There's nothing like playing an enchantment that lets you scry whenever a snow permanent enters the battlefield that eventually turns into a 2020 legendary black avatar creature token. That's beautiful. Morite of the Frost is just a really good changeling that is also a snow permanent. The Three Seasons, Graven Lore, Search for Glory, these are all cards that have seen pretty good play, I would say, in standard. So there's stuff people are probably aware of and would look and be like, oh, yeah, snow. I run some cards for flavor just because I also want to play something a little bit janky and fun. So there's a Glacial Chasm in here, which is not a snow permanent, but it is very useful for buying yourself a turn or two. And I guess I don't really need to mention Arkham's Astrolabe. A lot of people have feelings about that card.
Yeah, I hear that's been a bit of a problem.
Yeah, but I guess Sunstone is another one of those. I love these old cards people forget about. These old, you know, you're playing EDH and somebody drops something on the table and you go, oh, I've never seen that before. Can I see that? And somebody passes you the card across the table and you're like, oh, I need this for some of my decks, you know? So Sunstone isn't that good, but it's still fun. So it's a 3-mana artifact from Ice Age. If you pay 2 and sacrifice a snow-covered land, you have all creatures deal no combat damage this turn. So the ability to, you know, pay 2 mana and turn any land into a fog is just, I don't know how to explain how perfect that is some games, you know, because now everybody who was attacking into you is tapped down, and you get to decide what you're going to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I like having Tamio pilot this deck because I feel like her middle ability taps down two creatures and freezes them in place. And that just felt like it was on theme, in my opinion, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so I love that deck. I don't know that I've actually done the lists for either of these online because, well, I've got more deck lists than I've got decks posted on the channel. It's a real problem. The last one I want to speak to, I'm mentioning because you mentioned your Liliana deck. I want to mention my Liliana deck.
Okay.
So my Liliana deck is a Liliana Untouched by Death deck. So she's a 4-mana, 2/2 black, cost Planeswalker. Her plus one is to put the top three cards of your library into your graveyard. If at least one of them is a zombie card, your opponents lose 2 life and you gain 2 life. Her minus two is to give target creature -X/-X until end turn, where X is the number of zombies you control. And her minus three is to be able to cast zombies from your graveyard. So her ult isn't big, but it is useful, you know. Her signature spell, and this is probably one spell you've seen a lot in EDH, is Living Death.
Actually, not as much as you would think.
Really?
But
I guess it depends on the play groups.
Really. Yeah, it really does.
Yeah. In the right deck, it is the perfect one-sided board wipe, you know? So this deck uses a lot of dredge mechanics and things to fill up the graveyard. And then, of course, Living Death is often my win condition. It is running a amazingly large amount of zombies, and I'm pretty sure the only non-creature spell in the deck, or non-zombie spell in the deck, is Liliana and her signature spell.
Okay.
So it's almost an Oots All Creatures deck, but it's also kind of a combo deck in its own way, you know? So I am running some dredge creatures, you know, I'm running some things that make zombie army tokens or make zombies, by accident.
Okay.
You know, some shapeshifters, cause some of those are still good stop gaps, you know, but ultimately it's just a really fun swingy zombie deck. There's one or two cards that want to play into that. A, if I'm going to be losing my creatures anyway, I might as well burn everybody on their way out. So there's a Sir Conrad in here.
Okay.
And then there's everybody's most hated enemy to see in a zombie deck get resurrected all the time. And that would be Gary, our favorite gray merchant of Asphodel.
Yeah, makes sense. Always forget, you know, Gary's a zombie. That's the weird thing about it.
Yeah, you know, but because he is, it actually, he works in a lot of ways where a card may have you just go get a zombie or may have you return a zombie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Probably a notable non-zombie in the deck is Shadow Alley Denison. It's a 1-mana 1/1 vampire rogue that people forget about. It says, whenever another black creature enters the battlefield under your control, target creature gains intimidate till the end of turn.
Ooh, that's a nice ability.
It really is, you know. It's sometimes just getting around or getting through is the hardest part of playing at a table with a bunch of people is you have to get around or through. Now, I've also seen some very successful in the format stacks and hate bearer stacks, and that's not my play style, so I don't have an example of that. But it does exist. You know, and those decks particularly hurt me. I don't necessarily like playing against them, but it is a viable option. Pretty much anything you want to play is a viable option in the format.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. Because, again, I feel like, especially when you're talking to people who are trying to understand EDH, is that you basically present them, you can play whatever you want, but then also with the caveat, but, you know, some of these strategies may not be the most popular. And I think it takes some time to really understand what you enjoy playing and also, you know, what end of the spectrum you want to play on in your chosen format. So I can definitely understand where, again, depending on what you're looking for, what you enjoy doing, you're going to build the deck that definitely works for you. And again, it's going to have strengths. It's going to have its weaknesses. And
absolutely.
Yeah, it's just interesting to hear how we build decks, I guess, kind of the same, but kind of differently too, for two different formats. Yeah. But those formats are almost the same in a lot of ways too.
In a lot of ways, I think the biggest thing a EDH player is going to have a struggle with going from EDH to Oathbreaker, like I said, is the speed of the game. The going from 20 life, 40 life down to 20 life, and going from 100 cards down to 60. does make the gameplay and your deck building and your construction much tighter, you know? And I would certainly suggest to people who are just tipping their toe, big toe into the water, that don't put all your fish or all your eggs into the barrel where you have your high mana cards, because you're not as likely to get there in EDH. You know, I feel like because EDH affords people some extra turns to get somewhere, you're going to see Omniscience more often. You're going to see some of those bigger plays more often. I'm not saying it's not possible in Oathbreaker, but I want to set a realistic expectation as to what somebody can expect starting out, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of, I think, a good basic overview. If people want some basic information, I've got like a 1 minute video, an actual a 1 minute long video on YouTube that basically goes over the basic Oathbreaker format. You know, I want to do more of those because I feel like we can overcomplicate things. You know.
Yeah, definitely.
Sometimes it's just about starting the thing. You know, it's just about getting going, getting things started. Now, you asked me, you know, about my Oathbreaker decks. I guess I kind of want to pose the same question to you. What is your favorite maybe EDH deck you think could find new life in Oathbreaker that you might want to try out?
Well, I still have the boogeyman of my old Queen Marchesa EDH deck, which has sort of been soft locked out of my local playgroup.
That's a little tough.
Yeah.
To convert.
Yeah, but it's a very standard Mardu Aristocrats deck. It's got everything you want in there. Token creation, blowing things up, Marchesa herself.
I have some bad news for you.
Yeah.
We don't have a Mardu Planeswalker.
I know, but I could easily build it around something different if I wanted to.
Yeah, you really could. You could.
I probably could take red out, honestly. Red is definitely the weakest color in that deck, so I probably could get by running an Orzhov Planeswalker or even a Rakdos Planeswalker. I probably could get by with taking white out. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you've got some great choices in Orzhov, to say the least. Most of them are Kaya, but you do have some choices there. I personally think if you're running something kind of Orzhov, Sacrifice gets stuff back, the newer Kaya out of Kaldheim actually kind of has a blink effect printed on her, where when the creature dies, you get a spirit token and you return the creature to your hand instead of the graveyard. Mm-hmm. So that allows you to get a lot of replay out of your stuff, you know?
Yeah, that would definitely be really nice. Or I could change the focus of the deck to make it a little bit more aggressive as well.
Yeah. Well, and that's the upside, is having options. Something some members of my playgroup do, because they have people they play EDH with and they have people they play Oathbreaker with, is they use inner sleeves and they mark the inner sleeves for their Oathbreaker deck. And then they know which cards to remove when they switch their EDH deck to Oathbreaker and back and forth. So they can very quickly just be like, oh, these all have the dot in the corner. They all come out, you know?
Interesting, yeah, because when I was first getting EDH and I still had an Oathbreaker deck sort of available, I would just carry around the 60 cards that were sleeved for the Oathbreaker deck, and then I would try to build it up. I had another 40 cards or whatever to just sideboard in. Didn't last very long, but that was my solution.
Yeah, and I think if you do want to have an EDH deck that can play in either format, the easier you can find to help you switch gears between the two formats, more likely you're going to play and you're going to enjoy it and you're going to get more fun out of the deck. You know, having a deck that can adapt to different formats is actually kind of a fun thing, because you almost feel like you have a Swiss Army knife, you know? I do want to mention something I tripped over recently that I think could help new Oathbreaker players. Be careful about your signature spell. There's a couple of rookie mistakes that you can make, and sometimes you don't realize you've made them till after. If you want to play more competitive and your group's okay with that, then running board wipes as signature spells is probably okay. If you want to play more fun non-competitive games, then a board wipe as a signature spell can be very oppressive. Try not to run any spell in your signature spell zone that says destroy target planeswalker. I recently learned this lesson. I converted a Strixhaven Orzhov deck to a Kaya the Inexorable deck and decided to run Fracture as my signature spell. And it says, okay, for two mana, a white and a black, destroy target artifact, enchantment, or planeswalker. Even though the rest of the deck is structured like group hug, because I put destroy target planeswalker in my command zone, people were triggered. And they went after me hard because nobody wants to build a deck around their commander. This is true for EDH too. And be told before the game even starts they're not going to get to play their commander. You know? And then the last thing I'd like to mention that's a stumbling block for new players is maybe don't put a super expensive spell as your signature spell unless you only plan on casting it once. If you're running a Sarkon deck with Dragonstorm,
oh,
that's flavorful and it's perfect. And if you're only going to cast Dragonstorm once the whole game, that's fine. But if your signature spell is something you need to cast more than once, then it needs to be cheap because it's going to get expensive fast. And that's something that people don't always think about, you know. And in fact, that's also something to pay attention to when you're choosing your Planeswalker too. The 2-mana Tybalt that everybody thinks is trash in a lot of other formats, it's actually fairly good in Oathbreaker because it gets out ahead of everybody else. It's the same reason like a 1 or 2 mana EDH commander is going to have a run on the game and the table, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I used to have a 1-mana playing, or 1-mana commander for a deck that was not very good, but I liked being able to get them out on turn 1 versus everyone else.
Was it my favorite 1-mana commander?
That depends. Who is it?
Hope of Gyarpur?
No.
Was it the dog then?
No, it was not Izumaru. It was Ovia Pashiri, Sage Lifecrafter.
Oh.
Actually, it was mono green +1/+1 counters with some weird artifact sub themes. The deck didn't last all that long or do all that well. So it kind of tells you where that. I know J-Ro has a much better build of that, but
it sounds fun.
I digress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's something to be said about how small choices can affect the overall power of a deck. But, you know, don't let those choices make the deck something you don't want to play or you don't enjoy. I had a Saheeli deck. Not Saheeli Rai, the other one from War of the Spark.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Saheeli Rai is the only Planeswalker that's banned in the format as a commander, which is kind of funny.
yeah.
Well, she can give an instant or sorcery spell affinity, you know, so the fact okay. She could always make your signature spell free for the rest of the game causes
some
problems.
Yeah, would be a problem.
Yeah, especially if you're a jerk and you make your signature spell like an infinite turns, like take an extra turn spell.
Okay.
Yeah, because the thing with Saheeli is when you cast a non-creature spell for that, not for Saheeli Rai, I had a... The Saheeli from War of the Spark.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
I built it as an artifact eggs deck, mm-hmm. or I guess you could think of it as Cheerios. It was kind of skating the line between the two breakfast arch types, where you're running either all zero-cost artifacts or all artifacts that can trip you to draw a card. And anytime you cast a non-creature spell with that Saheeli, you get a 1/1 servo. And then that opens you up to play things that have affinity or things that are bigger or scarier or to just play through the deck and combo out very fast, you know. It was kind of similar to in fact, it even had her in the deck. It's similar to a Joyra.
Okay.
Weatherlight Captain deck. And in that, you're basically racing to the bottom. And I stopped playing it and I stopped enjoying it because I realized it was just very much a combo deck. Sometimes my turns would take forever and it just wasn't fun to play with other people. But it was Cheerios, any sort of artifact combo deck, you know, can actually usually be built on a budget very easily. You know, it's mm-hmm. if you want to build a competitive deck on a budget, that and mono red are generally where you start in any format. But I digress.
Man, you know? I must have been the only person to actually build a really junky Joyra deck in EDH. I ended up tearing it apart because it actually really didn't do much of anything, but it didn't combo out, and it wasn't very strong. So I digress on that particular bit.
Well, and the problem is whether or not your deck is the strongest version of Joyra, she now has a reputation.
Yeah, that was definitely part of it as well.
And that's one of the things I think I kind of like about Oathbreaker. So, taking a step back, one of the big things that I feel like is an advantage that EDH or Commander, whatever you want to call it, has over Oathbreaker is it was started by judges and it's been played for so many years longer and has built up a fan following as a format. And I think sometimes maybe Oathbreaker players or players of newer formats take that for granted, that a non-Wizard supported or sanctioned format has to be loved and cared for a very long time to be successful, you know? And EDH has done that. And I haven't seen many other things raised to that level. Pioneer didn't really survive, you know? I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of all the formats that didn't survive because it's a list. And I'm sure the professor has done it better than me, so I'm not going to worry about that. Because it doesn't have the age, you know, it doesn't have the same support, doesn't have the same type of things in place, none of the commanders really have that reputation most of the time of pulling them out and being like, oh, great, this is going to be that Lord Windgrace deck, you know? So even if your Joyra deck isn't the, you know, the optimized Joyra deck, people look at it like it is because there's that reputation, you know? Now, backpedaling a bit, when a Planeswalker has something that says you win the game or an opponent loses the game printed on it, that sets an expectation. You know, I would say the Jace that has the Lab Man, the Lab Maniac text printed on it that says you win the game when there's no cards in your library, that's problematic. You know, because people always expect you to build a certain way with him. If that makes any sense.
Oh yeah, definitely. Especially since you have access to him in your command zone, there that definitely would set an expectation where you're probably going to try to win that way, because otherwise you could have chosen a different Jace to do a different thing, like the OG Jace. You could still, I think you could definitely build around that. It's far more fair because the ultimate is milling someone 20 cards. Well, it's going to take you a while to get there, and then the payoff is nowhere near as strong at that point.
No. And the truth of it is, you don't necessarily, you can send a pulse positive. Just like in EDH, you have secret commanders. There's no reason you can't make that Jace your win condition in the 58. Put him in the deck. You know, you don't need to broadcast your game plan. In fact, doing so is detrimental to the game you're going to try to win. You know, people still do it. Like, it's if you see somebody running Ral Zarek and the spell they have in the command zone copies a spell, well, their plan is probably to make an infinite copy loop and have Ral Zarek burn all the players out of the game off of his static ability. And when I say Ral, I mean the Ral from War of the Spark. Sorry. The fact that there's multiple printings of people with the, with similar names always kind of screws with me just a smidge. You know, there's so many Jaces. Just there's too many. There's too many Jaces. I could use me maybe a couple more. I can't think of his name now. Grook. I'd like to have maybe another Grook. I was actually surprised he didn't show up on Strixhaven, given where the lore left off in.
Sure.
In the previous set, but I'm gonna let that one go. The timeline's a little messed up, so I'm gonna let Wizards figure it out. I'm not a spastic lore person, you know.
All right. So again, I think that's going to wrap up our show today. It's been great talking about Oathbreaker with you. I've definitely learned a lot of things, and I hope the listeners have learned a lot as well. So where can people find your content again if they're more interested in learning more about this format?
The first place I'd like to send people is, oh, I should have had this ready. This is what I get for not being the human being I want to be, but instead being the human being I am. So YouTube, they can search for me there and they can find Signature Spellbomb. Usually within my description or within comments, there's a link to my flow page. The reason I suggest that to people is you can subscribe from my flow page website. You can actually go, there's a link directly to the Oathbreaker rules page if you want to learn more, and that's where the ban list is. Then there's a link to the Reddit Oathbreaker group, which is actually controlled by the people who created the format. So they're usually able to easily answer rules questions just right in Reddit. And then there's a link to Break the Oath, which is a great place to find online Oathbreaker games, and Skull Symbol. And then all of my different links where people can choose to support my content or my channel are there as well. But to me, I've put a lot of resources on my Flow page to help people find Oathbreaker and the rules. So I would say if they find my content on YouTube, that's in my description box on all my videos.
All right. All right. Sounds good. And you can find me on Twitter at NTG in Quarantine. You can also find the back catalog of these podcast episodes on Spotify, Google, Apple, Player FM, MTG Cast, and many other podcast outlets. So again, I'd like to thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, certainly. Let me know if you ever want to have me back. I had a great time.
Yeah, it was great having you. And maybe someday I'll get that itch to get back an Oathbreaker and give it a shot again. I mean, I still have that Zombies deck effectively sleeved up. Probably wouldn't take too much time to at least get something put together.
You know, and it really doesn't. I feel like, well, maybe that's a conversation for another day.
Sure,
I can
sure.
go for hours. It's a problem I have.
All right. So,
well, thank you. Yeah.
So again, you've been listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. My name's MJ. Have a great rest of your day, everybody.